Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's meeting is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be the moderator for tonight's program. Before I introduce our distinguished guests, I'd like to introduce an old friend who's here who I was very surprised to see, Ambassador Jim Timby, Special Advisor to the Undersecretary and my former colleague during the Clinton administration years, a wonderful gentleman and colleague, so I'm very happy to see Jim here. And it's now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, the Honorable Ellen Tauscher, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. And, of course, as you know, a former member of the U.S. House of Representatives. 2 years ago, we met with Undersecretary Tauscher here in Lafayette, just as she was departing for her new role at the State Department in Washington, D.C. She was also embarking on a new marriage at the time. If I recall, she told us that night that she would be taking the oath of office and her marriage vows on the same day, which was pretty unique. Undersecretary Tauscher was well known to all of us here in this region, having represented the 10th District of California in the United States Congress for, I believe, 13 years. Well, a lot has happened in that time, even for someone who had previously been a successful investment banker, held a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, been an official of the American Stock Exchange, been an author and a businesswoman. In a major success, Undersecretary Tauscher saw the New START arms treaty with the Russians through to completion, bringing about a significant reduction in U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons. Even more difficult, perhaps, than the negotiations with the Russians, she was very instrumental in the negotiations with the U.S. Senate that succeeded in having the treaty ratified after a long and partisan battle. And there have been numerous other accomplishments in the arms control and international security field, a new nuclear posture review altering the U.S. policy on the first use of nuclear weapons, the first ever 45-country nuclear security summit, numerous counterterrorism initiatives, a nonproliferation review conference, and so many more accomplishments. For an update on her busy life and hard work on behalf of us all over the past 2 years, please join me in welcoming U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, Ellen Tauscher.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's goes without saying, it's wonderful to be back home in California. It's wonderful to be back in my congressional district. It's wonderful to see so many friends and family that I have been able to keep in touch with by email and other things, but not really see, because we don't do arms control with California. So I spend most of my time traveling out of the country. A little over half of my time I'm on the road and on an airplane, most of it with my colleague, Dr. James Timby, who is, as we call him, the indispensable Dr. Timby, who is a Princeton and Stanford-trained physicist who has been working for you since Richard Nixon was president. And yesterday we were over at Stanford to see Bill Perry and George Shultz. And as usual, people rush past me to say hello to Jim Timby. But let me say that if I've had any minor accomplishments in the last year on behalf of you and President Obama, it's because I never sit down at a table without having Jim Timby sit either at my right or my left. So if you don't mind, would you give him some appreciation since he's a humble public servant? And as some of you might know, I'm the new and improved Ellen Tauscher. Last year, coming off a trip to Pakistan, I realized I didn't feel very well, and I went and found out that I had cancer of the esophagus. And so I've had 8 rounds of chemo and 25 rounds of radiation, and I don't have an esophagus anymore. But I look pretty good, I think. And I did name my tumor something pretty heinous. And it did exactly what I told it to do, and it's gone. And so is the cancer, so I am very happy to say that it's been an interesting couple of years since I left working for you full-time, specifically as your member of Congress, which was an absolute blessing in my life. But I've stayed working for you for the last 2 years, working for President Obama and Secretary Clinton. And it has been an enormous ride, a terrific opportunity. And so I wanted to spend some time tonight, as I used to when I worked for you directly, giving you an update on what we're doing. When I found out I was coming out to see Secretary Schultz and Secretary Perry, I immediately called my friend Gloria because of the many blessings we have in the Bay Area, certainly the Commonwealth Club is one that provides us. You know, when I was in the Congress, I used to tell people I worked for the smartest people in the world, not because you elected me 7 times, but because you literally are the smartest people in the world. And so I think one of the reasons why you keep your fine edge and your attention to what is really important is because of the Commonwealth Club. And that's not a paid political announcement. I'm not allowed to do that anymore. But I do want to say and send my appreciation to Gloria. So let's talk a little bit about where we are and what we've been doing in the Obama administration on some of these issues. And I just want to say that we have a little long story to tell you, and then I'm happy to take whatever easy questions you might have. I also noticed that I have a number of former staffers here from my congressional office and a number of people who have been elected and took their medication on time and are maybe not elected anymore. But I see a lot of public servants in the room, too, so thank you all for being here. I'll be 60 in November, and some of you are a little older than me and some of you are a little younger than me. We were the children of the duck and cover exercises. I don't know about you, but I was pretty limber as a young kid, but I could not fit myself underneath that desk. And I thought the desk was going to come crashing down on me during the exercise, not about a bomb. But I think that we all understand that the international security environment has radically changed since the end of the Cold War. And in the Cold War, when we had massive United States and Russian nuclear arsenals that we inherited from decades of superpower confrontation, we realized that they've been poorly suited to address the security challenges posed by terrorists and unfriendly regimes seeking nuclear, chemical, biological, and other dastardly kinds of weapons. Rejecting the notion that the world must glumly accept living in the fear of nuclear annihilation, President Obama 2 years ago in Prague declared that the U.S. would seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. President Obama wasn't the first president to say that, but he was the first president to actually put a detailed plan together to achieve that. And although his words have galvanized many, some have criticized the president as being naive and the goal as impossible or undesirable. One of my predecessors in the previous administration likes to say that rather than a world without nuclear weapons, he would prefer a world where only one government has nuclear weapons. We tried that once, and it didn't last very long. What is often overlooked about the president's goal is that he emphasized the practical steps toward achieving the goal that would make us safer. He acknowledged that it would take patience and persistence to reach the final destination. He conceded that it might not happen in his lifetime. Yet not to try, President Obama argued, was to surrender to fatalism and the inevitable spread of the use of nuclear weapons. Tonight I'm going to discuss how far we have come on those practical steps and where we are headed on efforts to reduce existing arsenals, we call that disarmament, and to halt the spread of nuclear weapons, we call that nonproliferation. Disarmament and nonproliferation are two sides of the same coin. Countries with nuclear weapons will be reluctant to disarm so long as they face the prospect that other states may acquire such weapons. Similarly, countries might pursue nuclear weapons because their neighbors or others possess them. You cannot succeed on nonproliferation without continued progress on disarmament. And the reverse is true as well. This administration's success in concluding the New START Treaty has helped to strengthen the nonproliferation regime. Disarmament and arms control efforts enhance international security and promote international unity on preventing new nuclear states and nuclear terrorism. Nonproliferation helps create the security conditions needed to make further progress on reducing the roles and numbers of nuclear weapons. Since the President's Prague speech in April of 2009, we have made significant progress on both reducing nuclear forces and strengthening the nonproliferation regime. A core principle of the President's approach is accountability. States do not exist in a vacuum, and their actions affect and influence the decision-making and strategic calculus of all other states. As the President said in Prague, rules must be binding, violations must be punished, words must mean something. So we have followed through. When North Korea announced a nuclear test, this administration led the UN Security Council to pass Resolution 1874, imposing the toughest international sanctions to date against North Korea. The Obama administration also has united the international community to pressure Iran to comply with UN Security Council resolutions and its international obligations not to develop nuclear weapons. For instance, Russia recently passed up substantial profits to deny an Iranian request for an advanced air defense system. And I'm so glad they did, because my talking points every time I saw my Russian colleague was to say, please don't send the S-300 to Iran. Syria is also being held accountable. The International Atomic Energy Agency in June ratcheted up scrutiny of Syria's nuclear activities by reporting them to the UN Security Council. But accountability applies beyond just states. All countries in the world that possess nuclear technologies, materials, and expertise must be responsible for ensuring that those items are safe and secure from threat or misuse. In addition, states that serve as commerce or transportation hubs must be mindful of not facilitating illicit transfers. Indeed, vigilance is the responsibility of all countries, because the consequences of a single nuclear weapon detonating anywhere in the world would have global consequences. Seeking to cultivate a greater culture of accountability, President Obama hosted the 46 countries at the Nuclear Security Summit in Washington in April of last year. The summit highlighted the need to work together to secure nuclear material and to prevent illicit nuclear trafficking and terrorism. Participants agreed to secure all vulnerable material within 4 years. To measure our progress, South Korea will host another summit next March. In international relations, cause and effect can be hard to determine. But there is no question that our efforts to strengthen nuclear security and unify the international community on North Korea, Iran, and Syria have been aided by the Obama administration's efforts to live up to its own treaty obligations and to lead by actions, not just words. 1 year after the President's Prague speech, the United States issued its own nuclear posture review, which aims to reduce the role and number of nuclear weapons in our overall defense posture. That review declares that the fundamental role of U.S. nuclear forces is to deter nuclear attacks against the United States and our allies and our partners. The longer-term goal is to create the conditions to safely make that the sole purpose of our nuclear forces. To reinforce the security benefits to be gained by the states foregoing nuclear arms, the Nuclear Posture Review declared that we will not use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states that are members of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. That's a lot of words, huh? And those states that are in compliance with their nuclear nonproliferation obligations. Let me just tell you what that means. You can name on two hands the states that have nuclear weapons. All of those other countries that don't have nuclear weapons, that have signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, if they are in compliance with that, it says the United States would never use nuclear weapons against them. It's called negative security assurance. Never liked the name. I don't think something that's positive should be called a negative. But it is very clear in the nomenclature that what it's meant to do is to reassure everyone that the Obama administration comes out and says, we will not use nuclear weapons against you. You're not going to be surprised to find out that's one of the few clear statements that any administration has made to reassure other countries on that issue. So another act of leadership by this administration was negotiating and ratifying the New START treaty with Russia. The treaty entered into force in February following the Senate's approval last December. When it was fully implemented, the New START treaty will result in the lowest number of strategic warheads deployed by the United States and Russia since the 1950s. Earlier this month, Secretary Clinton and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov brought into agreement into force, committing each country to dispose of no less than 34 metric tons of excess weapon-grade plutonium, which represents enough total material for approximately 17,000 nuclear weapons. In short, the 2 years since the President's Prague speech have been exceedingly productive. Nevertheless, we are not meant to rest on our laurels. I can tell you with certainty that President Obama and Secretary Clinton will not let us do that. Despite the many pressing global challenges, the President has directed us to keep up the momentum and lay the groundwork for additional progress. With this in mind, I want to share our current and future plans to advance both nuclear weapons reductions and nonproliferation. Again, you really cannot do one without the other. Signing and ratifying treaties generally get all of the hype, but the real benefits come from the implementation. This is true for the New START treaty that just went into effect in February. For some of you that were watching this Senate debate during the most unlikely political time of the year, during the lame duck session in December, you may have received significant media attention, but there has been barely a blip of coverage ever since. So let me update you on the implementation of the New START treaty. The United States and Russia have exchanged data, held expositions, and notified each other on the status of our strategic forces. In fact, we have exchanged more than 1,000 notifications since February. We also have begun on-site inspections. To date, we have conducted 7 inspections inside of Russia, while it has done 5 here. The access and information derived from this treaty provide important predictability and stability in the U.S.-Russia nuclear relationship. And why is that important? It's important because the United States and Russia hold over 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. Without that access and information, the risk of miscalculations, misunderstandings, and mistrust would be great. As we implement the New START treaty, we are preparing for further nuclear reduction negotiations with Russia. Under the President's direction, the United States government is reviewing our nuclear requirements. The Department of Defense and other agencies will consider what forces the United States needs to maintain strategic stability and deterrence, and consider factors such as potential changes in targeting requirements and alert postures. As we consider further reductions, we are making the investments to ensure that the United States will retain a safe, secure, and effective stockpile, so as long as nuclear weapons exist. Our intention over the next 10 years is to invest $85 billion in the nation's nuclear infrastructure, including Lawrence Livermore Lab and Sandia National Laboratories in Livermore. It may seem counterintuitive, but these investments will allow greater reductions because the same infrastructure is used to eliminate warheads. And with greater confidence and capability in our infrastructure and people, we will not have to keep so many spare weapons in reserve. Right now, as many of you know, we have weapons and we have hedge weapons. Those are the spares that we keep in case we open a box and have that oh my goodness moment. And so if we have confidence in what's in the stockpile, we don't have to keep all of those hedge weapons. And we can start to put them down and make sure that they are gone. In addition to our internal review, our approach to the next nuclear reductions agreement will be informed by the ongoing NATO deterrence and defense posture review. The primary task of the NATO posture review is to ensure that NATO has the appropriate mix of conventional nuclear and missile defense capabilities necessary to respond to 21st century threats. From our perspective, we want to ensure that NATO's posture and policies are not inconsistent with the positions laid out in the United States nuclear posture review. We have made clear that NATO reductions should occur in the context of Russia taking reciprocal measures to adjust its nuclear posture, including reductions in its non-strategic nuclear forces. Our overall objective with Russia is to seek future reductions in all categories of nuclear weapons, strategic, non-strategic, warheads, including non-deployed weapons. No previous arms control agreement has included provisions to limit and monitor non-deployed warheads or non-strategic warheads. To do so will require more demanding approaches to verification that will require extensive consultations between us and Russia. As we work to reduce the excessive leftover weapons from our Cold War confrontation with Moscow, we must also counter the threats of today. One of the most serious challenges we face is from ballistic missiles, which can be used to deliver weapons of mass destruction. The Obama administration is dedicated to developing and deploying effective missile defenses. The phased adaptive approach approved by President Obama in 2009, which provides a missile shield for our NATO allies and American assets in Europe, provides a more effective and a more timely response to the most likely missile threats that we will face in the foreseeable future. But you do not need to ask this administration to toot its own horn. Just ask our own NATO allies. For the first time last year, NATO fully embraced our proposed missile defense approach of protecting all European members' territories and populations. That was a very significant milestone, given the past contentiousness of this issue. While getting our NATO allies to support this effort was a significant challenge, we have now embarked on an even tougher task: convincing Russia to join us in cooperation on missile defense. We believe that such cooperation can provide Russia confidence that our missile defenses will strengthen strategic stability and enhance both nations' capabilities to defend against emerging missile threats. At the same time, the President has made clear that cooperation with Russia will not in any way limit United States or NATO missile defense capabilities, and that the NATO alliance alone bears responsibility for NATO defenses. With both Russia and China, we want to transcend traditional thinking on strategic stability, often associated with MAD, mutually assured destruction, and instead build upon what we now call a new concept, mutually assured stability. This would be a new approach to achieve stability. It would create incentives for achieving cooperation and avoiding conflict. Mutually assured stability would be based on mutual interest, respect, and peaceful cooperation. While differences would remain between every state, states would share an overriding interest in peace and stability that is underpinned by arms limitation, nuclear and conventional, and other confidence-building measures. That is why the Obama administration is dedicated to the ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the CTBT, and negotiation and ratification of a Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, or an FMCT. Both agreements, yes, what I spend my whole day doing alphabet soup. Both agreements can limit the modernization and expansion of arsenals among other countries with nuclear weapons, as well as the acquisition of nuclear weapons by those countries that do not have them. Let me very briefly address the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. The Obama administration is committed to working with members of both parties in the Senate to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, just as we did for the New START Treaty. We have no illusions that this will be easy. But we tend to stress three essential points as we make our case to the Senate and to the American people. First, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty ratification serves Americans' national security interest because it will help lead other states to ratify the treaty and thus strengthen the legal and political barriers to a resumption of nuclear testing, which could fuel the nuclear buildup in Asia. It will help prevent the further advancement of nuclear capabilities in unstable regions, strengthen our leverage with international community to pressure defiant regimes that engage in illicit nuclear activities, and lend the United States greater credibility when we encourage other states to exercise restraint or hold others accountable. Second, we are in a stronger position today than ever before to effectively verify the treaty through the international monitoring system set up under the treaty and our own strengthened national capabilities. The international monitoring system demonstrated in 2006 and again in 2009 its ability to detect underground nuclear explosions, despite being incomplete at the time. Third, Our nuclear stockpile has been kept safe, secure, and effective for almost two decades without nuclear testing. As I mentioned earlier, President Obama is committed to increased funding for the U.S. nuclear labs and the full nuclear complex to ensure that we can continue to have confidence in our stockpile without testing. Indeed, our nuclear experts say that we know now more about our nuclear weapons work than we did when we explosively tested them. In essence, the real argument is simple. We have been abiding by the treaty for 20 years. We've been living with the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty for 20 years without testing, but we have had no benefit of locking other states into that same commitment because we haven't ratified it. I should note that Glenn Seaborg, whose name adorns this wonderful learning center, was a champion of the test ban. In a book published 30 years ago, 16 years before the Comprehensive Test Ban was completed, he argued that such a ban would help increase stability, impede arms races, and lend greater credibility to U.S. efforts to stop the spread of the bomb. His reasoning was right then, and it is right now. Prohibiting tests is in our national security interest, and so is ending the worldwide production of fissile material for weapons purposes. That is the objective of the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty called FMCT. We do not need any more fissile material that could be used to make more bombs, especially when we know terrorist groups are seeking to get their hands on such material any way they can get it. Our preference is to negotiate a fissile material cutoff treaty within the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva, but that body has been deadlocked by Pakistan for almost 2 years. Thus, the United States is joining with other key countries to start preparations for a fissile material cutoff treaty negotiation elsewhere until the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva can get down to work. Although that's a pretty full agenda, we also have our eyes squarely on Iran, Syria, and North Korea, and the dangers posed by future proliferation. After 2 decades of clandestine nuclear activities, Iran continues to refuse to comply with its international obligations. Iran is moving in the opposite direction of addressing international concerns by declaring its intention to triple its capacity to enrich uranium to nearly 20%. Iran also continues to move forward with its enrichment and heavy water-related activities, all in violation of multiple UN Security Council resolutions. As the Obama administration has repeatedly said, we do not dispute Iran's right to a peaceful nuclear program. But with rights come responsibilities. Iran has a responsibility to restore confidence by the international community in its exclusively peaceful nature of its nuclear activities. We are going to maintain pressure on Iran until it engages in a constructive way and complies with its international obligations. The same goes for Syria. Syria must uphold its international obligations, including providing access to any site or information deemed essential by the International Atomic Energy Agency to complete its investigation into Syria's clandestine nuclear activities. Our policy with North Korea remains the same. We do not accept North Korea as a nuclear weapons state. We remain committed to the 2005 joint statement and its core goal of verifiable denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula in a peaceful manner. We urge all countries to implement UN Security Council Resolutions 1718 and 1874 fully and transparently. And we are encouraging all states to take all measures necessary to impede North Korea's efforts to develop its nuclear and missile programs and engage in proliferation activities. The United States continues to closely consult with our partners in the six-party process. We are pleased last week when the North and South Korea negotiators met with each other on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit. To determine whether North Korea is serious, Secretary Clinton earlier in the week announced that the United States has invited a senior North Korean official to visit New York for talks later this week. Nevertheless, we have made it consistently clear that before any resumption of the six-party talks, North Korea must improve relations with South Korea and demonstrate a change in behavior, including taking irreversible steps to denuclearize, complying with international law, and ceasing provocative behavior. As the President has said, the United States will lead efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons. But we cannot do it alone. We require the contributions of all, and we need to make use of all the resources and tools available. One of the most important tools is the International Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA, whose mission is to help countries maintain appropriate nuclear safeguards, safety, and security, while also verifying that civilian nuclear weapons programs are being used, not being used covertly for to create nuclear weapons. We are seeking to improve the IAEA's ability to investigate potential and actual undeclared nuclear activities and to apply effective and efficient safeguards at declared nuclear facilities to ensure that they are not abused or misused. A key initiative is getting all countries to adopt what is called the Additional Protocol to give the IAEA additional authorities to do its job. All told, nearly 140 states, including the United States, have either signed or concluded additional protocols since 1997. We are engaging with those states who have not yet signed the additional protocol to do so. As more countries potentially turn to nuclear power, the IAEA will be vital to providing confidence that the threat of nuclear proliferation does not grow with the demand for nuclear energy. Underscoring our efforts to support peaceful uses of nuclear energy, this administration has pledged $50 million in a new fund for the IAEA activities toward that end, and we are encouraging other countries to raise another $50 million. Describing the Cold War era, President Obama said, "Generations lived with the knowledge that their world could be erased with a flash of light." Our purpose is to help create a world where future generations can harness the benefits of the atom while not having the same fearful knowledge. For our part, we declared in the Nuclear Posture Review that we would only consider the use of nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances to defend the vital interests of the United States or our allies and partners. It should come as no surprise, given our military's ever-increasing emphasis on precision and of the avoidance of non-combatant casualties and collateral damage, attributes not associated with nuclear weapons, by the way. The NPR states that this is in the U.S. interest, that all of our, that all other states, that the 65-year record of non-use be extended forever. The only guaranteed way to realize that goal is to eliminate nuclear weapons, which is, as I have described, going to be a gradual process. But we cannot proceed at a glacial pace either. Delay or inaction on either disarmament or nonproliferation will erode momentum until both grind to a halt. Let me conclude by returning to an observation by Glenn Seaborg in his book of 30 years ago. While hopeful that the political will was emerging for a test ban, he lamented that Washington and Moscow had settled for driving testing underground in the early 1960s, other than going for a complete ban. As a result, Glenn Seaborg judged that the value of a test ban had diminished over time because the United States and the Soviet Union were negotiating at a higher and a more dangerous level. Yet, Glenn Seaborg warned, "If we allow the present opportunity to slip away, however, the next one, if there is a next one, will be at a level still higher and still more dangerous." The Obama administration is determined not to let our opportunities slip away. We are focusing carefully on each practical step to ensure our footing on steady ground as we follow the president's path to a more peaceful world without nuclear weapons. I want to thank you very much for your attention. I know that this is pretty opaque and somewhat dense stuff to kind of wrap your brain around. But as I said, you are the smartest people in the world. There's not going to be a test after this, which is the good news. But I'm happy to try to answer any easy questions you might have. And thanks again for your attention.
Thank you so much to Undersecretary of State Ellen Tauscher for those profound and provocative remarks.
Thank you.
And now I look forward to having a conversation. And really, I would tell you that looking at the questions, there are a lot of very well-informed people here. I see, I think, Roger Falcone over there from Berkeley and a number of others. So actually, there are some very good questions for you.
Good.
I'm struck in what you said by how much is going on in this area, with the president, with the commitment to really do something about these issues, and folks like yourself who are implementing that and leading and helping him. yet how little is being covered in the media, how little we see about the developments and all of the different initiatives that you were talking about. So arcane only in the sense that it's hard for people to get information these days about this very important topic. So thank you for giving us the update.
It's my pleasure.
Let's go to questions, and they're going to really go all over the area that you talked about. You talked about New START and the dismantling of weapon systems that's going to go on. Here's a question which asks, if we still can't find storage for the used nuclear material from power plants, how are we going to be disposing of weapons-grade plutonium? How reversible is the disposal of this material? What's the difference between weapons-grade plutonium and the used material from nuclear power plants?
Well, the agreement recently signed by Secretary Clinton and Foreign Minister Lavrov, when Foreign Minister Lavrov was in town just 2 weeks ago, we had an entire day of meetings, Secretary Clinton, Foreign Minister Lavrov, and our teams on many different issues, and at the end was culminated with a plutonium disposition agreement that we have negotiated over about 7 years that we finally put into paper about a year ago, and now we've signed it. It's an executive agreement. The challenge has always been, what do you do with fuel? Can you downgrade it and blend it and make it more safe to store? Yes, we know we can do that. Can you do other things to it? One's called MOX, which is something oxide, and basically
mixed oxide.
Basically, it's a down blending of it. There's obviously been tremendous controversies about Yucca Mountain and what do you do? What do you do? And I think until Fukushima, which is obviously a terrible tragedy on many, many levels. The idea, there was a renaissance about nuclear power, perhaps not in California, but certainly around the United States. But after Fukushima, you saw Germany that has probably about a 35% reliance on nuclear power for its electricity decide to get rid of all of its nuclear power plants. So the challenge of what to do with fuel is a significant one, and I will tell you we don't have an answer to it. We have many answers to it, but we don't have a single answer to it. And I think that for many people, the answers that we do have are not satisfying because there is not a sense of ultimate safety and security. So I think that is a continuing problem. The nuclear renaissance will never really happen until there is a solution to that. I work very closely with Dan Poneman, who is Deputy Secretary of Energy, an absolutely terrific guy. And I know that we have Ron Cochran here. I saw him. Here he is, from the Livermore Lab. So we have a lot of people that are spending a tremendous amount of time and energy on making sure that should the United States decide that nuclear power is part of a blended solution of many different opportunities to get us away from fossil fuels, that we solve this problem first, that we don't kick the can down the street, because I frankly think my constituents in California won't be satisfied until they get a straight answer.
So previously, when we've had dismantlement of nuclear weapons taking place in Russia and other countries, we've actually purchased some of the highly enriched uranium.
Yes.
In that case.
Yes.
And blended it down or had it blended down and used it in nuclear power reactors.
At Savannah River.
Do we have a follow-on agreement covering any of the material that would come out of the weapons the Russians would be dismantling?
Yes. We have a number of other initiatives to make sure that when you dismantle weapons, you have that sense of relief that now you have this weapon that's now gone, but now you have material that is not safely stored in a weapon. Now you've got to find a way to safely store it so that a bad guy doesn't get their hands on it. They only need about the size of a tangerine to really do some damage. So you have to make sure that all of the material is accounted for. We have very sophisticated programs, as you know, Gloria, with Russia. They're basically called MPCNA, material control protection and accounting. And down to the most infinitesimal little pieces of it, you have to know where it all is. And at a time in the 80s and 90s, right after the Cold War in the 90s, the United States spent tens of millions of dollars a year securing that material because Russia, now Russia, then the Soviet Union, didn't have the money to do it. And I actually went with Ron Cochran and a number of people from the Livermore Lab in 1999 to see their facilities, which were absolutely decrepit, lakes glowing in the dark, people that were sent to the Urals. They took everything. They took their little grandmother. They took their kids. They went, you know, with two or three generations. And then 50 years later, some of them were still left, and they had been completely isolated. And they were in towns, 10 cities that had no names on maps. And I went to one of them called Snezinsk, and it was in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, these people really needed to have jobs. They couldn't feed their families. And where they were storing the material, they had people standing in front of it with a gun with no bullets in it. And so the United States, in what are now famously called the Nunn-Lugar programs, cooperative threat reduction, Sam Nunn and Dick Lugar went to Russia at the urging of people from the Livermore Lab and others, and they said, let me show you this. Their gates and guards have no teeth. Their holes have fences. The people can't feed themselves. This is, you know, it's a complicated mix. You need to secure the material. You need to secure the scientists that have any knowledge of how to do these things so they have credible work so that they're not, you know, going to a day spa for terrorists. You have to make sure that, you know, the things that they've built over the years, they may look old, but they actually work, so you have to make sure they're secure. So there's many, many pieces of this. And the United States, once again, this is, you know, I was the House sponsor for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which we were glad to see. We got rid of recently, and this is almost the new Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We've done amazing things on your behalf with your money to secure material and people and know-how, both in the former Soviet Union and other places. We took all of the material and all the know-how out of Libya, you know, 15 years ago. But people don't know about it. And it's a very important thing for you to know about, because what we have done is, I think, in multiple administrations, both Republicans and Democrats, was very smart and very strategic use of your money to buy down the risk that bad people, or people, frankly, of goodwill but in terrible circumstances because they couldn't feed their kids or they didn't have something to do, got under the thrall of the bad guys. And so I think we're very confident that most of that has been, or all of it has been secured. But it's still an enormous challenge and one that we find that we have to constantly repeat, because we have other countries where we want to be sure that they're securing their weapons and their know-how at the same time, too.
You mentioned the Fukushima accident. This questioner asks, Japan's recent tsunami and nuclear meltdown remind us that complex systems can fail in unexpected ways. To what extent are we still at risk of accidentally triggered nuclear exchange between the U.S. and Russian arsenals?
Well, I'm very confident that the days of miscalculation that lead to mistrust, that would lead to misuse, are behind us. But at the same time, that's why we work so diligently at the relationship with Russia. The Russian Federation and the United States, as I said, are holders of 90% of the world's nuclear weapons know-how. We have an obligation to our own people and to the rest of the world that the weapons that were developed to deal with what we called mutually assured destruction at the time are taken down in a responsible way. We are signatories, and we are actually with the UK, the United States, Russia, and the UK, are what are called the treaty depositories for the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is a singular document. I urge all of you to take a look at the website for the Non-Proliferation Treaty and understand what it means. Article 6 says that we will disarm. It doesn't say when, but it says we will. And so part of what President Obama has been made very clear in his seminal speech in April of 2009 was other people have talked about the United States getting rid of its nuclear weapons. Republican presidents like Ronald Reagan did. There was actually almost a negotiation to do something like that. But at the same time, almost every president that says he wants to get rid of the nuclear weapons is called naive, no matter who he is, because there are some people that actually think nuclear weapons are cool and that they wouldn't mind using one or two, and they don't mind the idea of testing. Yeah, I know there are people like that, but, you know, they are in the minority now, thank you, and we want to have them get into a growing minority. But at the same time, we have to have a balanced approach to our national security. We have extended our nuclear deterrence to our NATO allies and to other countries like Japan, partly because they needed the protection, also partly because if we used our umbrella over them, they didn't need to buy their own. And so countries like Japan and others who have had troubled pasts, it's important that they used our deterrence so that we actually got the benefit of having built these weapons, not only for ourselves but for others, but we also prevented others from building their own. And that worked for a long time until others realized that there was a special club for people that had nuclear weapons. They were treated differently. And some people wanted to be treated like that, and they wanted perhaps a little bit more credit and a little bit more appreciation than they necessarily deserved. Usually those people were countries led by dictators that really weren't even feeding their own people. North Korea comes to mind. Certainly Iran comes to mind. And they decided that they wanted to be in that club because they were appreciated more and that they could hold their own people in a certain way. They could have regime security if they had nuclear weapons, and they could hold their neighbors at a distance, and they could pretty much do what they wanted. And so President Obama's made clear that that's not a goal that we enjoy or that we're going to respect, that you have to live up to your treaty obligations, and most countries are signatories to the Nonproliferation Treaty, and we're going to hold them accountable. And so that the United States very visibly does with Russia what we have to do to disarm and to do it in a very responsible and very visible and very verifiable way so that we can hold people's attention when we want to go after countries like North Korea and Iran that are doing things outside the lane of responsibility. So it's complicated, but it's very, very important.
For our radio and podcast listeners, this is the broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker today is Ellen Tauscher, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, discussing prospects for U.S. and international security in the midst of a complicated global environment. I believe you were at Stanford in part discussing potential collaboration with the Russians on missile defense. Mm-hmm. It's long been our missile defense programs have been perceived by the Russians as a threat to them.
Yes.
And a number of scholars have for a long time advocated the idea that perhaps since the threat really is other countries with nuclear weapons to both the United States and Russia, that we could perhaps collaborate on our missile defense programs. Can you tell us a little bit about this initiative?
Yes. For over a year, we have been negotiating with the Russians about in September of 2009, President Obama announced a new way of dealing with missile defense. The previous administration had announced that they wanted to put 10 ground-based interceptors in Poland and a very sophisticated, what's called a TPY-2 radar in the Czech Republic. And they announced this around 2006. In 2007, while I was working for you full-time as a member of the House of Representatives, we took the majority as Democrats, and I became the chairman of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee of the House Armed Services Committee. That was my responsibility, was missile defense, the nuclear weapons complex, space satellites, and other things I can't tell you about without killing you. I opposed what the Bush administration wanted to do because it was called the third site because it was actually redundant third site. The United States proper, what we call CONUS, is protected against the Iranian future threat, which has not emerged yet, for long-range missiles, and the prospective North Korean threat by two facilities, one in Fort Greely, Alaska, and one in Vandenberg, California, by about 45 ground-based interceptors that would work like that. If we saw something that we thought on a certain azimuth was going to be coming toward the United States, it would be done without anybody putting down their coffee cup because you can't think about these things. They're pre-planned and pre-programmed, and we would take it down. The third site in Poland was meant to be a third site to protect the United States. I thought that was a bad idea, and I took the money away. And then I started to invest in what's called SM-3, which is a very successful 25-year-old Navy missile that's on Aegis ships. And the good news is in 2008, President Obama won, and no good deed goes unpunished. And because of that, I got asked to go into the administration. And so now we have a thing called the European Phased Adapted Approach, which is we're protecting our European allies, because we can be held hostage in any moment by an Iranian mid-range missile sitting in Iran targeting Turkey, because we have what's called an Article 5 agreement, as many of you know, with NATO. And that says that we have a mutual defense. It's like the Lafayette and Orinda fire departments, mutual aid. You know, if you have something that goes wrong and you find yourself tipped over in Orinda, you're going to have Lafayette go and help you. And Article 5 was the most controversial piece of the NATO agreement that we made after the Second World War, where we decided to have this Atlantic Alliance where the United States and Canada in North America would be part of this, what has now become 28 countries, that would have this mutual aid agreement called NATO. The first time NATO's Article 5 agreement was actually invoked, and the controversy in the 50s and 60s was, we don't want to go back to Europe again and stop them from fighting. We spent too much money, too much treasure, and too much blood. We don't want to go back and do that, and so there's a lot of opposition to NATO. The truth of the matter is we've never had to go do that. Europe is pretty much unified. And the first time Article 5 was ever invoked was, shockingly, not in the benefit of Europe, as was always hysterically promoted, but in our benefit. And when was it?
9/11.
September 11th. The evening of September 11th, after a NATO meeting in the afternoon, their time, they invoked Article 5, and they sent AWACS planes to fly over New York and Washington, and 2 days later over California. It was the first time they'd come to our defense, and they did it without our asking, and they did it immediately. And so we have this, you know, mutual aid agreement. But the United States, because we believe in it, because we've invested in it, we're vulnerable anytime somebody attacks Turkey. And we have, as you know, tens of thousands of American troops in and out of Europe. A lot of them are in southern Europe. And so we're held at risk anytime somebody wants to hold at risk one of our European allies. And so the president, President Obama, said, we want to protect against this current threat, not just the old threat, but against the current threat of Iranian and Hamas and Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations who have short and medium range missiles and rockets. You can remember from just a few years ago what was happening from Syria and Lebanon into Israel. That kind of thing could be happening from the Middle East into Europe, and that would really hold America at risk. And so President Obama put the USS Monterey on station in the Mediterranean in March. It is an Aegis-capable ship, and it has missile defense on it. And it says, we have a defensive system. It's not an offensive system, but don't think about it. And we've come now, and we're standing guard to make sure that you do not put us at risk. And I think that was very valiant of him. And so now we have two other pieces of it that will come in 2015 and 2018, more capable system that will go in Romania, another capable system that will go into Poland, and that will protect us against the emerging Iranian long-range threat. And that caused NATO to be not only very appreciative, but to change its mission for the first time in 27 years to include territorial defense of people and places with this new system. And it's America's gift to NATO, but it also protects us, obviously. And it's called the phase-adapted approach. We've now asked the Russians to become a partner in that. It's a very complicated relationship. For 35 years, Russians have believed that American defensive systems can be turned to be offensive systems, and that they are targeted to undercut their strategic deterrence. Russia will tell you, it's not a surprise, that they have perhaps an overdependence on their nuclear weapons. They don't have all of the different things that we have. They don't have the kind of fighting force that we have. They don't have the ships, the planes, and all the other things that we have. So they're over-dependent on it, and they don't want that strategic deterrent to be undercut, and they think that that system might do it. So it's a very sophisticated, right, Jim? Very sophisticated conversation that we're having with them. It's ongoing. I spend a lot of my time going there, or they come here, and we hope that we can find an accommodation where they believe that this is in their national security interest to partner with us. If we are able to be successful and we have a missile defense cooperation agreement in the future with Russia and with NATO, it is a huge game changer. Because for the first time in well over 60 years, it will be something that we deploy together, that isn't about my building a 10-foot fence so that they build an 11-foot ladder. And it will stop the incessant tit-for-tat that we've had. You've got that. Well, now I'm going to do something else. And da, da, da. The truth is we all acknowledge we don't have the time or the money to do it. And frankly, we don't threaten each other. And it's smarter for us to understand that we have common threats that we need to deter and defend against. And when we can identify them, it's even smarter for us to do it together because we not only leverage each other's capabilities, but we watch each other's back. And that takes down the escalation that we've had for so many decades of mistrust and miscalculation. So it's a big deal. It's going to take a while to do, and it's not necessarily going to work. But Jim and I are acting like it's going to work, and we're working hard to try to do it.
Well, it's a breakthrough idea. We wish you well with it. So we meet during a big fight in Washington over raising the debt ceiling and over our economic and fiscal policy in general. So I think this question is appropriate. Susan Eisenhower wrote recently that national security includes economic strength, not just military strength. Considering today's need to trim the budget, comment on the opportunity to reduce spending on nuclear weapons that will never and should never be used.
That's why I said it was counterintuitive for the president to actually increase the funding for the National Nuclear Security Administration in the short term. And it's 10 years, and so it's not that short of a term. But it is, it's almost paradoxical that spending more money on our weapons actually secures the ability for us to take them down. We have, as you know, two boxes of weapons. We've got the weapons that we're going to use and the ones we plan on using, and then we have a box of what we would use if the other ones weren't available. And those are the hedge weapons, and it's necessary for us to have them because if the time should come, God forbid, that the president was advised by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs that he had to either in retaliation, assumably, use a nuclear weapon, it better work. Because it would be meant to stop further escalation of a war or further damage to the United States. It is a much higher test for the president to assume to use that kind of weapon. There is no doubt that many people believe that the president actually would never use that kind of weapon. But until the time when a decision is made that weapons are actually going away and the United States can safely get rid of ours, we have to have a safe and reliable and effective deterrent, not only because of ourselves, but because, as I said earlier, we have extended our umbrella to others, most notably our NATO allies and to Japan. And so because of that, we need to know that these weapons, no kidding, do work. Now, how do we know that? Well, we don't test them anymore. We haven't done that in almost 20 years. We know that because we did over 1,000 tests. And we did over 1,000 tests in a very, not surprisingly, methodical way. We kept all the records. We also have built the largest laser in the world in Livermore, California. We have the smartest people working at the labs, and we also have the fastest computers. So we have figured out, we meaning euphemistically they have figured out how to simulate a test, and they know how to look for things that would cause them to say, this category of weapon, either a W or a B, is how the front of them is, and then there's a number, 7661. We're worried about this, the characteristics of this. We found out just about 7 years ago that plutonium, the half-life of plutonium is actually a lot longer than we thought it was because the people that did this 15, 60 years ago were enormously conservative. So there's a lot of good news about the way we built these weapons. But at the same time, we have to have a safe and reliable and effective stockpile. We have to make sure that they work. We're not going to be testing, so we have to make investments in people. We have to have a 21st century complex to make sure that we can secure them, and we have to make sure that we do this in a way that says that we can start to take these hedge weapons down. It's not just about these weapons, by the way. I can't tell you the untold medical, everyday science, tremendous inventions that have come out of the weapons labs over these last 60 years, microwave ovens, things that you just can't believe, and stuff that's on their shelves, things that they do. The NIF isn't just about simulating a nuclear explosion. It's a potential for a new kind of energy that is going to be not like nuclear energy, not with problems of waste, but a completely different way of doing things, very much like Star Wars and very futuristic. So these inventions have dual uses, and they have a multiplicity of things that come out the back end that are almost too big and too many for me to recite to you. But suffice it to say that the money that is spent on these things isn't just spent in the name of war, isn't just spent in the name of science. It's spent in the name of the American people for good, for the good of knowing that we can prevent anything from escalating, and that we can prevent from bad things from happening because we do have the strongest deterrence that anybody's ever seen.
So here's one close to home. What are the chances of a terrorist acquiring a device which could be detonated on a ship entering San Francisco Bay or a plane landing at SFO? And I would add to this, and what are we doing specifically about that type of threat?
Well, we've known for a long time that it's important to have cargo inspected, and it's the toughest thing to do is to inspect cargo. So what we did was we said that we don't want to care about this at the five-mile limit. We don't want to care about this in Oakland in those containers. We don't want to be looking at those things thinking, I hope somebody looked inside that and knows what's in there. So what we did was we moved this, and this was in the aftermath of 9/11. We moved what we call the trusted shipper programs all around the world to the ports. So in Singapore and in Hamburg, places all over all the ports are all over the world. We have very significant and very sophisticated measuring devices, sensors, testing, all kinds of things that say that unless you're a trusted shipper, unless we actually know what we think is in there, we're not going to let you put it on that ship. And by the way, we're going to have discrete testing of what is going into these things. And we're going to be doing surveillance, and we're going to be doing raids and all kinds of things to make sure that we know what's in there. Is it foolproof? No. We still, by the way, have cargo that goes onto passenger planes that's really not tested. It's not really secured. So there are loopholes in this program. You can imagine every democracy would have them. If we were a perfect state that was all buttoned down and locked in, you wouldn't want, number one, want to live in it, and number two, it wouldn't exist economically very well. So it's very difficult to do this. It's expensive. It's time-consuming. A lot of this stuff is perishable, so it's got to move. So it's important for us to be cognizant of what the material handling train is to make sure that we're not disrupting it too much, but at the same time that we're secure. I can't tell you that I think that we're absolutely safe. It would be a fool that would tell you that they are. People will always leverage our democracy and our need for freedom and our desire to treat each other with respect and without suspicion. They will leverage that. They will do it. And unfortunately, they will do the thing that none of us would ever do, which is risk our own lives to make a point. And those are things that are very difficult to defeat and defend against because they are almost out of our own minds. So I can't tell you that we're absolutely positively safe, but I think we're as safe as we can be and should be. And I know that we're spending a lot of time and money on it. I know that a lot of valiant and very, very patriotic Americans work hard to do it. But it is still possible for somebody to do something crazy because they will risk their own lives to do it.
There are so many good questions. I hesitate to wrap this up, but the time has come for a last question. This one starts by saying, thank you, you look great.
Thanks, Mom.
Since leaving Congress and having been at the State Department, what has been your most challenging task? What have you enjoyed most in your new position? And I would refer to both issues and also process of how the government works and how the process works.
Every member of Congress basically is an entrepreneur, and they have their own budget, and they have 657,000 people that they work for, and they kind of run their own shop. And I liked doing that. I still think that I'm a young entrepreneur of about 25. And the truth is, you know, you go into a big bureaucracy like a new administration, there's 27 people that want to read what you're going to say, and they're going to change this and that. And we are involved, obviously, in the National Security Council, and so we go to the White House a lot. And there's a lot of people that have something to say about what you're doing. And I really appreciate that when they agree with me. And sometimes they don't. So I have to bite my lip and just kind of, you know, talk them into it. So I like my work. I like my work and I like what I'm doing. The hardest thing was to leave my job working for you. And the hardest thing was to leave California. I didn't know that I was going to get cancer, but I knew that I was going to spend most of my time traveling out of the country. I didn't know that I would only be here twice in the last 2 years. Being home the last 4 or 5 days has been the best tonic that anybody could ever give me. Seeing my friends that I talk to on the phone and email and love very much. Seeing them physically has been helpful. For having them see me after having such a scary time and tough recovery, I know has been good for them too. So that's the hardest thing for me was to leave my job. I'm glad I'm not in politics now for lots of reasons. And I feel sorry for some of my colleagues that have to withstand what's going on. But I think that I'm very blessed that I'm in public service, and I'm very blessed that I could have a small part in what's going on. So I think it's been fascinating to negotiate with many different countries. And I'll tell you that it's amazing to sit down in front of the American flag sitting on the table and to think that I get to do that. And just as the president is only an American creature, I consider myself an American creature. When I was leading the delegation to negotiate the New START Treaty, we had more women on the delegation than had ever been. When we finally got it, even though people didn't think we could do it, when we finally got it, and I called Hillary, Secretary Clinton, and she went, "Really?" I said, "Yes, girlfriend, we got it." Now, it's only in America. So I think that, it's been a great ride, and I hope I get to stay on the ride a little longer.
Well, in addition to the thanks we would normally offer, we thank you for continuing in this high-pressure environment with all the travel, the hard work, and accomplishing so much through your health challenge. That shows incredible dedication and service. So our thanks to Ellen Tauscher, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security.
Thank you
so much for being with us and all that you've done.
We
also thank our audiences here in Lafayette, on the radio, television, and on the internet. I'm Gloria Duffy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're always in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.